Okay, so I think the discussion we want to have is about what is the status of the art, about understanding gravitational wave backgrounds from cosmology. Okay. So the first thing to realize is that when we talk about cosmological backgrounds, we are always talking about stochastic backgrounds. Okay? So this is why we are talking about backgrounds and not just single event signals. If we talk about what are the typical sources, we can give some general classification and describe some basic properties of them. We could do the following classification. We could think as a main source, inflationary background, which it's really model-dependent circumstance, but in specific scenarios, you can definitely have significant production of gravitational waves. Then we could have preheating or other non-perturbative effects. Okay. Then we can have first-order phase transitions, and we can have also topological defects, in particular cosmic strings are possibly the most interesting case to deal with. So maybe to say just some very, very general aspects is that all these sources can be very different from each other, but they share in common that they have the ability to produce significant amount of gravitational waves that potentially could be observed or detected somehow. So the spectrum, if you want something that differentiates these sources, is that whether the spectrum is broad and spans over many decades in frequency, or whether the spectrum is rather localized in a single peak or bump, all right, and therefore does not span into many decades of frequency. So of these, typically inflation is certainly one with a broad spectrum, and cosmic defects also, whereas preheating and non-perturbative parametric effects or first-order phase transitions are those with a single bump. Okay. Now, we can also characterize or differentiate these sources by discussing how are they potentially observable.
Sorry, can you remind me, with the cosmic strings, there's something about cusps hitting each other.
Yeah.
Is that...
So you want me to discuss already the details of one of the guys? Well,
that's in, okay, whatever you planned.
But... In cosmic strings, you know, in certain, well, in most of the modelings, you chop off loops from the general network,
yes.
And these loops can develop to have cusps, and these features in the loops actually radiate gravitational waves. You can superimpose all these gravitational wave emissions, and this gives rise to a stochastic background of gravitational waves.
Why is it broad? I'm just being slow.
Why is it broad? Because it happens all along cosmic history. So all along cosmic history, the network goes chopping off loops, yeah. And then you have to do the contribution superimposed from all the history.
Is it broad because the characteristic size of the loops is changing relative to Hubble?
Or no, it's that broad. Well, the fact that it's changing is important because it means for a given frequency today, I have to sum the contribution from all the redshift signals from all the loop distribution in cosmic history, which means of a given size in the past is going to contribute the same as compared to a smaller size in the more recent past, you know. So if you want, let me put it this way. It's impossible. We lead a discussion in 1 hour about all the sources. So today, what I was thinking to do was to focus on preheating and non-perturbative stuff because we had some discussion last Friday. We had some interesting debate whether this could lead to observable gravitational wave signal or not. And I was also thinking to give you some brief summary of the case of cosmic strings. So Rafael was telling me that maybe this is too much, still these two cases. So what we are going to do is I'm going to finish this general classification. Then I'm going to give you some discussion on this to clarify what we discussed last Friday, which is about the observability. And I'm going to derive it in full detail so there is no doubt this time whether really the signal is observable or not. Then we will pass to Mauro, and after Mauro tell us how we can really measure this with Lisa. If there is time or people have interest, I'm very happy to address this topic.
Okay, as you said, this could be something to discuss on Friday, I guess, if you don't mind.
Up to people, I don't mind. I don't mind. So, I was saying, another interesting aspect of how to differentiate these guys is how to observe them. You know? Typically, inflationary signals, we are rather thinking to look to try to search for them at the CMB. There are some scenarios where potentially if you choose the right interactions and the right strength of couplings, you could produce presumably an observable signal within the range of LIGO, LISA, or the will-be next generation of detectors of interferometers. But this is typically not natural outcome of inflation. This is something you need to put by hand, both the type of interaction and the strength of the coupling. So certainly, inflationary signals, typically you can look for them at the CMB, but this is not the case of preheating and first order phase transition. It is, however, the case of cosmic defects in general. What about gravitational wave interferometers? Well, actually, for sure, in principle, you can look for first-order phase transitions. You can look for cosmic string networks. That's guaranteed. Then this is the doubt I want to approach today, whether we can look or not from preheating sources. My answer is going to be essentially no. But then I'm going to show you also what are possibly the circumstances under which parametric excitation of fields could potentially lead to observable signal.
By CMB, you mean B modes, right?
CMB, I mean B modes, but even before B modes, for instance, topological defects also produce vector perturbations, and this also affect temperature and isotropies. So you could also put constraints from the temperature-temperature correlation and isotropies directly. The strongest constraints, for instance, in the string tension, it really comes from B mode nowadays. And for inflation, of course, I mean B modes, because since there are no vector perturbation from standard inflationary scenarios, then we only look for tensors. And in principle, B mode is only sensitive to tensors.
B mode is also generated by vectors. It's just not generated by scalars.
That's what I meant. That's what I meant. So, but in the case of inflation, typically we do not expect these vectors, whereas in the case of cosmic defects, we do expect them. So actually, when I say we put constraints from B modes here, it's both the vectors and the tensor from cosmic strings.
So there has been some work also on, for gravity waves from oscillons and cue balls.
Yeah.
Are you also going to mention?
Well, collaterally, you know, if you want, in this discussion, I think you can deform it to consider the case of oscillons and any kind of object that you create out of parametric effects due to the oscillating presence of oscillating field. Okay. So, okay, I think if I understand correctly what Rafael really wants or what is really more appropriate given the time scale we have, let me give you some discussion on this topic. Then we'll see if we have some time to address that.
I mean, this would naturally connect to the previous discussion.
Yeah, that's right. This naturally connects to what we were discussing that I will address in a moment last Friday. And this could be connected to a variety of things that I think there are other experts in the room which could be postponed to Friday.
Yeah, we have time. So this could be on Friday or depending on whether, I mean, if you have time later today, we can just.
As my dear French people say, à la carte. Yeah. You know?
It's a discussion.
So, let me consider this. Let me not call it preheating. Let me just say parametric excitation of fields. And for the sake of the exercise, let me give you a paradigmatic example of some potential of a field, say, that has a minimum at zero. So to be consistent, we give some mass scale, and then we can put some dimensionless coupling, self-coupling there also. And let me couple this guy to some scalar field, let me call it chi initially, in this manner. So this is a paradigmatic example when we want to study preheating. Okay? And Kaloyan was already leading a discussion on how complicated it is, the non-perturbative dynamics, typically in this scenario. So I'm not going to repeat that. I'm just going to give you some brief guideline to arrive where I want to, which is the production of gravitational waves. So solution to the dynamics of a homogeneous scalar field that dominates the energy budget, say the inflaton. This is very simple. This guy is essentially a damp oscillator with this kind of potential. So it has a decaying amplitude, and it has an oscillatory part. And this decay really depends on this exponent. It simply goes as something like this. Might be a bit wrong, the numbers, but you get the idea. It decays with the expansion of the universe. So essentially, we have our inflaton. Later on, we'll see whether this can be something else other than the inflaton, which is oscillating like this with a decaying amplitude. So there is an envelope. At the same time, we know this other X field is coupled to the inflaton. So essentially, due to the dynamics of the inflaton, it's going, or to this oscillatory field, it's going to be excited. Let me write down basic way to understand this very simple fact. In order to do that, let me just make some conformal rescaling of this kind. So let me, define some chi variable, which is the original field X times A, some curly phi variable, which is original oscillatory field normalized by its initial amplitude. Okay, there's going to be a typical initial amplitude here. And let me also emphasize that if you think in terms of the potential, this looks like this. So essentially, we are addressing a situation where our field starts oscillating at some scale here. And there is also some curvature scale associated to the potential, which I'm going to call omega star squared, okay, this curvature. Essentially, if you want the initial energy density of our problem, it just comes from that, from this potential, because initially this guy is not excited, is of this form. Okay? Now, if I use these rescalings, and I also define conformal dimensionless time, and let me say also dimensionless spatial coordinates. So you see, I'm rescaling everything by the natural frequency scale, which in this problem is literally given by the typical curvature of this potential. So in doing that, what we arrive into is an equation for the mode functions of this field chi, which is originally x, which looks like this. Kappa squared plus q squared phi squared xk equal double derivative of scale factor times xk. All right? So this is an oscillator-like equation. And of course, if this guy is oscillating, and it changes sufficiently fast, at some moment it changes non-adiabatically this frequency of the modes, then we are going to excite these guys. So this is what generically is happening here. Independently of the structure of the resonant bands that Kaloyan was explaining very well last Friday, here, because they are expansion of the universe, those bands are blurry, okay, because the structure of bands only is something rigid, let's say, or visible when you are in the absence of expansion of the universe. So the bands are not so clear, but what is clear is that because I have an oscillator type of equation here for the modes of the field chi of the preheat field, whenever this condition is sustained, okay, that's called violation of adiabaticity, we are going to excite in a non-trivial manner these guys. And this is essentially what parametric resonance is about. It's about the fact that I have oscillatory scalar field that oscillates up and down all the time. And every time it crosses around zero, There is a small window for the field values here for which this condition actually is fulfilled. And when this happens, actually, the generic outcome is that kappa, the typical normalized momentum, it's of the order, it says, so this is only sustained, sorry, if you want, for the condition kappa smaller than q to the 1/4, where q, which I have not defined yet, is the so-called resonance parameter, which contains all the physics of interest, actually. This is a very rich parameter because it codifies everything. The strength of the interaction, the initial condition of the field, and the properties of the oscillatory background. In this case, it's curvature at the onset of oscillations. Okay? So, and kappa, of course, what it really means, sorry, is just momentum, for moving momenta, measured in the natural frequency scale.
I mean, you can have parametric resonance, this is getting ahead, but you can have parametric resonance and all of that without even having the initial potential energy, right? You go through the point where the chi field is massless and you produce, and then you go back and forth, and eventually the curvature of that potential just doesn't play much of a role.
No, it's just the typical time scale in which we are oscillating. And the reason why we call it resonance is because although the effect I'm discussing here has to do with a single crossing, and in that sense you are right, this is not related to that scale, the repetition of the effect is what builds up a resonance, because you build up quanta on top of the previously produced ones, and this is what that curvature is important, just because it tells you the modulation of the effect.
That means you're working in a particular regime where that is the case. I mean, I'm saying, even if the curvature were zero, you would have this.
Oh yeah, I could have a complex, I'm in single field oscillatory case, so I could have a difference into
I just mean there's this trapping effect regarding.
I'm limited to this context, okay? This very peculiar context, that's all I'm describing. Okay, so in this context in which I'm start with a single real field oscillating, I think the key effects to capture the excitation is the fact that there is a broad band which is limited up to this cutoff, and this is really characterized by this resonance parameter which depends on all these guys. You know, that's all I'm saying here.
I think, Daniel, the other thing, just we've discussed this already, but even if you said, you know, even if you said G equals zero, you still have a phenomena. Half parametric resonance, because the field is.
That's very interesting case, which is even in the absence of this guy, since this is nonlinear physics, unless I choose this to be quadratic, then you can have self-resonances, because there is an effective resonance parameter associated to itself.
Okay. I mean, I think in what we're each saying is you erase one of the two terms, you still have the
effect. Like both terms are not.
This is true, but typically self-resonances build much slower than when I do broad resonance with a preheat field. That's also true. So it's really more interesting, typically, to work out preheating through direct coupling. Typically can be challenged, probably, but
it's true, but
Sorry to keep blaming this, but all I'm saying is eventually the thing that dominates is the essentially linear energy density. It's not really potential energy, the rho of phi, that it's eventually linear.
So what's linear? Sorry, the fact that you mean to approximate this guy.
Once you, even without that guy, if you have chi turned on, you have some, you know, variance of chi, and that scales like 1/5. So the energy density ultimately depends on phi linearly. So you have, that's what the parametric resonance does, is it builds up this, you know, quickly.
So typically energy density grows exponentially fast here, because the modes are growing exponentially fast, but we are in a linear regime, linearizing at the level of perturbations, fluctuations of this guy. I don't know if by linear you mean that, sorry.
No, I just mean...
He was, I think, discussing a different regime from the one you're discussing. You're discussing the beauty is attractive.
Well, that's where I learned the effect, but it goes back to the usual Hoffman-Linney-Stravinsky business, right? But yeah, I'm saying that the... As the field rolls, it produces the chi's depend on phi, and that contribution to the energy density is linear in phi. So it's in that sense that even if you erase the first term, you would still have this back reaction.
This is what I don't know what you mean linear in phi, you know. what I'm familiar with is how to look at the excitation of these guys, which, if you look into the spectrum of them,
you're just saying you could erase for a term and twice as fast as phi, and you still
get drawn back. You still get drawn back by the expectation.
So I guess you're asking why the phi star and omega star and so on are introduced in this way.
I totally agree. There's a regime where what I'm saying doesn't happen immediately, but eventually, what happens is you develop this linear force backwards, and then you produce more particles, and the linear force gets stronger and stronger and stronger and stronger. And it's, you know, of course, but let's just keep going with what you're doing.
Sorry, yeah, is this about the back reaction of the produced chi's on phi?
Yeah.
It generates an effective potential which makes phi oscillate regardless of the
Right. Okay, so if that's what you mean, I'm not yet there in the sense that I'm in the linear regime in which I'm just exciting these guys and they are building up energy and they are far away yet from having reached the background, the energy of the background, okay? So the typical picture in these broad resonance scenarios is that you have an infrared band here where you make the amplitude of your spectrum of these preheat fields to grow very fast because of this resonance. And then eventually, of course, their energy catch up at a certain level with the background one, and this is when back reaction starts and the system becomes nonlinear and very complicated. And actually, this is when we produce gravitational waves, and this is when precisely the parametrization I'm going to try to do in a moment. But the picture I would like you guys to understand here is that, you know, despite the fact that there is expansion of the universe and this makes very blurry the distinction of bands, there is still always the effect because we know there is infrared band for which there is this growth due to parametric resonance up to this scale. Okay. So the point is eventually this system will do back reaction into the original oscillatory field. So the system will become nonlinear. You will, through a scattering of the different modes, propagate some power here. But parametrically, the scale up to which you excite fields is always controlled by this Q to the 1/4, you know. And this is kind of relevant for the parametrization I want to do. Because now, let us think in gravitational waves directly. So essentially, if we solve the equation for gravitational waves, essentially, we have to sum over the gradients of all different scalars involved here. And when you plug in some field that is doing parametric resonance like this, the result is that when you plug it here and you take the transversalist part, the spectrum of gravitational waves at the time of production versus kappa is essentially inheriting the same scale. It's growing exponentially fast because the source is growing exponentially fast due to parametric excitation, and it is, inherits the same scale at the peak of this spectrum. And I will show you maybe some plots after the blackboard discussion, but you see the logic I would like you to understand is that quite generically, when this resonance parameter which codifies all these elements is larger than one, we do have this broad resonance effect, and we produce, therefore, we expect gravitational waves around this scale. So now the question is, how do I redshift this background to today, and how does it look like? So let me do some basic math here. So we know this is the typical scale, okay, which means if you want k over omega star. So there is this specific scale, is k star, is this units of omega star. So essentially from the equation of the gravitational waves, I could easily write this. And then let me call these gradients just the source term. Okay. Now, the formula for the energy density of gravitational waves is a bilinear over the first derivative of the tensor perturbations. So essentially from here, of course, I could also write this because the characteristic time scale is precisely that k star. And just solving for what is this guy, order of magnitude, immediately we arrive into pi s square over k star square over Planck mass square. So now, if instead of rho gravitational waves, we compute the ratio to the total energy density in that moment, say gravitational waves to the total energy density, this goes, let me take this expression and multiply by Hubble rate squared up and down, just as a trick. And what we end with is with this expression. So the fraction of energy density of gravitational waves you can produce due to this phenomena is essentially controlled by the relative size of the fundamental scale at which your spectra are being picked, which depends on this resonance parameter, and the ratio of your source to the total energy density available, squared. And this is pretty generic parametrization. We can use it in phase transitions, in preheating, or in whatever other causal source that acts like this. Okay, this is very generic. Now, for the sake of the argument, so the discussion we had the other day on Friday was whether we can observe or not this background. Okay, that's the discussion we had. Let me put this the biggest possible value we could think of. Say this is 1/3, so this is going to be maximally up to 10 to minus 1. In reality, when we do simulations, I very often have things of the order 10 to minus 4 to 10 to minus 6. All right? But let me be generous and say we take the maximum possible fraction of the anisotropic stress to the total energy density of the background. So this would be up to 10 to minus 5. Then let's say we redshift this. Redshift is actually very simple. It amounts to multiply by some function here that I will tell you now what it is, and omega gravitational waves. Okay? Oh, sorry, omega rad today. Where this function, epsilon, is nothing else but a parametrization of the expansion history of the universe between time of production and the onset of radiation domination that we don't know. So this is characterized by some, this is an exponent there, okay? This is characterized by the equation of a state during that period, which of course depends, for instance, on the shape of the potential. So, I think we are getting into more or less everything I want. The amplitude of the peak, of this single peak background, of the order of today, this is of 10 to minus 5. In reality, there is some ratio on degrees of freedom changes, which typically gives you an order of magnitude suppression. So this is of the order of 10 to minus 6. Let me put it here. So today, this is of the order of 10 to minus 6. Together with this, let's say 10 to minus 7. So essentially, it cannot be larger than this. This is the first point, okay? And then times h squared over k star, or h star squared over k star. Now, k star, I've already written it several times. Let's write it again. It's q to the 1/4 times omega star. H star is just using the, let's say, the Einstein, the Friedman equation, 3 over Planck scale, and then the energy density characteristic of the problem, of the background, which was of this order. Okay? Well, so I take the ratio, and I plug it here, at what we end with, let's not forget this, okay, although it's irrelevant for this discussion, so this is of the order of 10 to minus 7, q to the minus 1/2, and then phi star over Planck mass squared. So essentially, potentially, am I missing some term? Maybe this, if we want to be consistent. If we want to know what's the typical amplitude today, we just need to know what is the resonance parameter and what is the amplitude at the onset of oscillations. This is what really controls the parametric amplitude today. And of course, if you put this amplitude pretty large, say of the order of Planck mass, as it happens naturally in this monomial system potentials of inflation, then we can have very large gravitational waves, no doubt about this. The question now is at what frequency? Okay.
How do you think these oscillations happen that matter?
To be, so when they happen, they build parametric resonance.
I'm just asking you how many of
those
how many of those happened?
Yeah. So before we see back reaction in the lattice, typically we can have between 100 to 1000 oscillations for a standard m squared phi squared, lambda phi to the fourth, for a standard couplings of that kind that give rise to broad resonance.
So you're stopping it when it starts to back react, is that what you say?
The system becomes nonlinear, so we stop the instability, and then since the system is nonlinear, you saturate that growth, you slightly growth until you reach some certain equilibrium.
That's where it starts with fragments and whatnot, right?
The fragmentation, I would say, is at the time of back reaction. So if I look at this in the picture of real space, we see like inhomogeneous distributions which collide with each other. And this is at the time of back reaction because this is when this preheat field has had quite sufficient energy density.
Okay. And all of that is in the simple estimate?
Yes. Well, if you do, this is based on the linear regime of growth of perturbations. Once the system becomes nonlinear, as I was arguing here, you are going to have a complicated evolution of this spectrum, which might displace a peak slightly to the right here, but still with a cutoff, which parametrically is controlled by this. So the actual details of that determines the final actual details of this exponent and the actual number here. And I can tell you typical numbers we really have in preheating scenarios with phi to the n potentials are rather 10 to minus 11 to 10 to minus 13. So as I said here, I was being very generous given this. And typically, this exponent really ranges between minus 1 half and minus 1. Okay. And this difference with respect to minus 1 is due to the nonlinearity. Okay, and I'll show you some plots if you want in a moment. But you see parametrically, I'm capturing well what is the scaling of the signal. If you don't change this very abruptly, minus 1 half of minus 1 is not so crazy the difference, of course.
Okay, just a comment, if you don't mind. This pi s over rho star, right? That number can't be, it's only the energy density in gradients at most.
Yeah.
So that number is never greater than 1/3.
Yeah.
So pi s over rho star. Right?
And in most scenarios of broad resonance life explored, is way lower than this 1/3.
I think it's definitely, yeah. In some of the cases, for example, when you have trilinear couplings,
yeah.
As you know, in that case, it does reach.
I think that's a good point. So for this quadratic coupling, it seems not possible to reach such a saturation of this 1/3 rule, or I've never seen it, let me put it that way. For other kind of coupling, it seems possible. So it's okay. I'm going to be generous and I'm going to maintain this. The conclusion here is that you can produce very large background gravitational waves and it has very simple parametrization. Okay? It really depends on the amplitude of this guy and your resonant parameter and your prehistory before radiation domination. But, okay, for instance, if you are in lambda phi to the fourth, these oscillations already amount to a radiation background, so this is zero. Because I plug in 1/3 here, and then this is power to the zero, so it's one.
So for the first rho GW that you wrote, which inverse proportional to Q, should I think as a time, like a duration of the scalar production or something? Like, why is it inverse?
So this one?
Yeah.
Why is it?
Why is it 1/Q?
It's a 4.
Sorry. Actually, okay. This is exact formula.
So in the end, the Q comes from the K.
The Q comes from K star from taking this ratio. Yeah, okay. That's right. That's where it comes from. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry about that confusion. Yeah. So, well, as I was saying.
Question?
Yes, sure.
You've sort of already said this, but how much of the gravity wave comes from the turbulence afterwards versus when nonlinears kick in and get like these bubble-like objects hitting each other?
So most of the gravitational wave amplitude signal we see in these simulations, at least in the ones I've done in broad resonance of this kind, it really comes from the actual moment of the collision and fragmentation of these guys. Once you enter into the so-called turbulent regime, the mode functions evolve adiabatically, so too smoothly, and you don't produce gravitational waves anymore. Okay? At least in this context of classical field theory like that, there is no production. So essentially, once you fragment your condensate and your preheat field, that's the end of gravitational wave production. It is from that moment when I do the redshift of my background.
And that's why these approximations are good, because this only captures
the exactly. Otherwise, I would have to extend to longer times, and I wouldn't be capturing well the physics. That's absolutely right. Yeah. So now, let me discuss what I've been avoiding to leave it until the last moment, of course, which is, what's the typical frequency of this background?
Sorry, Jack, I just have one more question. So you alluded to how this varies with your little n. Can you just say that quickly again?
So what do you want me to know? What's the difference with different n?
You've already said small anyway, but yeah. Which way does it go with n, little n, your little n?
Which way does it go? Well, little n would enter into the resonance parameter, because the resonance parameter is this ratio. So little n would be here when I take second derivative of the potential. But essentially, I would say this is pretty generic for whatever n, as long as I have this result, if you want, is pretty generic for as long as I have this kind of monomial potentials. So at the end of the day, if you want to do the exact numbers for a given shape of the potential, well, I'll show you the results in the lattice. And you'll see that they vary little, but they vary. You know, so it's I cannot write any explicit dependence on n here, other than through here. You know,
it also changes the epsilon parameter, right? Epsilon star. Because
good point. Sorry, I was forgetting about this. It does change the fact that depending on n, the oscillations of your background actually give rise to an effective equation of a state of one kind or another.
Right.
Okay. So it changes slightly that also. It modulates there. Yeah.
But this epsilon star captures the expansion history after back reaction, right? So after the condensate kind of goes away.
Well, it really, yeah, because, you know, after I've contributed to last contribution of gravitational wave, I want just to redshift. Mm-hmm. Okay, and to do redshift, I need to know the expansion history between that moment and onset of radiation domination. So this is what I'm plugging here.
Can't, after fragmentation, you can't use the condensate n. Phi is not a condensate anymore.
Yeah.
Right? So it's already fragmented, so you can't use the n to determine what the expansion history is afterwards.
No, I have to follow the actual dynamics from the simulation.
It might just be 1/3. It need not be based on n at all.
Oh, that's the sorry. Yeah. Sorry. Yes, but okay. You know.
His problem is going to be zero. It's going to be minus.
Yes.
But didn't find that for a mass though.
Yeah, so as soon as
you have mass symmetry.
It's just matter. But it does matter, however, during the time of production itself, you are living in a background, no?
Sure.
So, yeah, okay, I see the point. So it's not so relevant, little n here.
Because that is after fragmentation.
Yes.
So it could if there's any mass, it will just be,
yes.
It's probably zero, at least if this is the only.
So after fragmentation, we jump into 1/3 rather fast.
Oh, well, if you have no.
If there is massless degrees of freedom, sure.
What about the cuspy case that we've also discussed in your talk? Because I didn't check that it's fine.
It's possible to. Yeah. Okay. That I have to check. I haven't done
it. Anyway, I think the relevance of this formula is that no matter what's your case, if you have anything that deviates from radiation domination, then you should plug it there, okay, to do correct redshifting. So,
one question: what are the degrees of freedom?
Yes.
So here we just counted the x degrees of freedom, is that right?
Yeah. Well, essentially here, you know, we could plug in this typical ratio of different degrees of freedom between today and in that moment. And you know,
so the degrees of freedom at that moment is in the numerator, is there?
This has to be smaller than one number. So yes, the degrees of freedom in the numerator,
okay,
in the denominator.
So if I have a 10 to 20 x particle,
yes.
I increase the.
No, that's the radiation path, right? So that's just the standard model. It's like 106.75.
But he has a ratio of the degrees of freedom.
Yeah, but it's the ratio of.
Yes. I mean, I
think more general question is that if I have many copies of X particles.
If you have many copies, there's got to be a limit in which, of course, due to energy conservation, you've already transferred too much energy into this. But initially, making copies initially probably would amount to produce more gravitational waves. But I'm not sure how it scales with multiple copies, to be honest. I have not cleared this in my mind right now. It's a good question. Let me say what really connects with the discussion last Friday, which is what is the frequency of observation of this background. In order to do that, we just have to redshift these typical modes, no? These typical frequencies till today. So I'm taking the ratio from the moment of production to today. Essentially, if you want, you have to subdivide that into up to the moment of radiation domination, then from then on till today. Then we have this. Then, of course, this we know because we characterize it by an energy scale at this time and the energy scale today. So essentially, you end writing this epsilon star we had before to the 1/4, so it's very mild dependence. Then we have k over the actual 4th root of the energy available in the system in that moment. And then the energy today, let's say 4th root of rho 0 today, we convert it into Earth. And this is the big number that it appears and the origin of the problem, if you want. So this is generic formula of redshifting modes k from that situation where our energy scale is rho star. Okay, and this is generic formula. It has nothing to do actually with parametric resonance. So now we know what is the typical scale here. We've said it a number of times already. Typical scale parametrically is cubed to the 1/4. The typical frequency scale. And we also know what is the typical energy density of the system, since it's the 4th root. Well, we put it already taking the 4th root. All right? So if I take that ratio, essentially what we end with is that we have this guy, then we will have some q to the 1/4. And then we will have a ratio between this guy and the initial amplitude, all of it to the 1/2 times 10 to 10 hertz. Okay? And this is now not generic formula. This is specialized in the case of a study where the physics is of broad resonance that excites momentum up to this scale and the typical energy densities of this scale. All right? What is the problem? Okay? You can probably already see it. This is apparently, because of this factor here, very large frequency. So if I wanted to make it observable, say we wanted to observe it at LIGO. Okay? At LIGO, the characteristic frequency is of the order of 10 to 2 Hz. So from this formula, say we take as an example 10 q equal 10 to 4. All right, well, sufficiently large parametric resonance. Could be 10 to 8, could be 10 to 12. But let me take 10 to 4 for the simplicity. So this gives me a 10. So 10, 10 to 10, 10 to 11. I have to convert that 10 to 11 into 10 to 2. So this can only be done if the separation between the typical frequency of oscillations of my oscillatory background is some 18 orders of magnitude smaller than the initial amplitude at the onset of oscillation. Okay? This is the problem. If I want to do this at LISA, then separation is even worse because the frequency is more infrared, it's on the millihertz. Therefore, the separation between the typical frequency of oscillation and the initial amplitude has to be of the order of minus 28. And if I make stronger my resonance parameter, I just make worse this problem. Okay, I just have to, if I make it 10 to 12, I add another couple of orders of magnitude there. So this goes to 10 to minus 20, this goes to 10 to minus 30. Okay. So this is generic formulas, if you want, for parametric excitation of fields that dominate the energy budget of the universe, whether this is the inflaton or something else. So the question is, when is the inflaton, can I do these separations? The answer is no, when I have this kind of monomial potentials. Due to CMB constraints, we know very well what is the constraint in the amplitude of curvature fluctuation and in NS, and this typically implies for these scenarios that separation of the scales between these two guys is of the order of 10 to minus 6. And this is the case for phi to the 2, phi to the 4, phi to the whatever you want in reality. Of course, these models in reality, when the power is even 2, is already put under a lot of pressure from CMB.
So at this point, you're saying something about the inflation model being nothing but this phi of the n with no crossover or anything.
Well, the thing is, the other day we had this discussion that if we could, you know, envisage a situation in which we could put this signal at observable frequencies. And then I failed to really realize, to grasp that the problem in this scenario, when this is the inflaton, is that CMB constraints really, for this type of potential, certainly.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying if it's more of a plateau-like situation.
I will get into that in a moment, okay? But if it's this type of potential, we are certainly forced to live with this constraint. Therefore, no way I separate this case like that.
Okay, and can I ask another question? So I think I've understood that you're saying something generic about the frequency, regardless of the amplitude.
Mm-hmm.
So if I were to play with, say, proliferating the number of these chi fields, it would not change that, even though it might enhance the amplitude, or is that the way to go, or?
I think we would change it. So the frequency, I think, would be changed, but I suspect the following, but I'm not completely sure. I think a number of copies, n copies, of these guys essentially amount to make a shift of Q, an effective Q, n times bigger than single copy. So this is where the number of copies would enter. At least this is my experience when I do parametric resonance with Gauge bosons coupled to a charge scalar field. Since parametric resonance of Gauge bosons coupled to charge scalar field is very similar to this parametric resonance, this would be my guess. But it's really a guess I'm making here. Okay?
Okay. Well, I mean, like, yeah. I think the dynamics could be, I mean, this is just a ridiculous limit for fun, you know. For
yeah, to do 10 to 20 copies, of course. But it's good for the sake of the argument.
The back reaction is going to kill you, though, right?
Well,
this thing is limited by your back reaction.
It's going to affect things. Yeah, when you say it's going to, you may be right that it kills the effect too, but that's a different statement, right?
But you see, back reaction will kill us sooner, but we'll have inhomogeneous distribution of all the fields initially, right?
But I think
it's up to a certain number of copies. Because if it's too many copies, maybe in one single pass at zero, we transfer everything.
You still have to conserve energy. You still have to conserve energy. So your factor pi s over rho star is still going to be a third, right?
I think in terms of frequency.
What do you think you're cranking up by cranking up the fields? You're just distributing the energy amount
more. So according to that, Peter, I think this would be very much in agreement with what I was saying before about the case of gauge fields, because in reality I would even decrease the signal. You know, because probably you transfer less energy per degree of freedom, and effectively what you make is like a super preheat field, which is the sum of all of them, which gives n times q, and therefore, since there is this negative power here, you even kill more the signal. Certainly doesn't look you're making it grow because of what you say from energy conservation.
But that would let you get to lower frequencies, though. Because
yeah, exactly.
Q's not it wouldn't. I think that formula won't.
It will change because of the g squared. The you can take the n counting of the g squared, and that should have 1 over n scaling there, just from number of variable counting.
Well, here I'm neglecting change of degrees of freedom here, which should be also there. But as you know, these goes at ratio to the 1/12 in the case of frequency.
So yeah, we're talking about hypothetical, so 12 is a small number.
Yeah. Compared to 10 to 20, yes. But it's interesting case. I don't have it completely clear.
Let me ask another related question, since there's I'm a broken record on this kind of question, I suppose, but if it were strings we were producing instead of chis. Now, it's not right to approximate strings as just a lot of species of fields, particularly in the context of string versus particle production at some level. So you produce these huge pairs, I'm wondering if that might affect the frequency. The thing is, they can then decay into smaller loops instantly. This is not the same as but I guess I'm wondering if that has already been asked and answered in the negative in terms of...
I think you're just limited to the fact that you can't do causal physics on scales bigger than the Hubble scales.
Right? So the frequency can't change because of that.
So you can play to the lower scale and do all this at like TV scales. So that's what you backed into.
So you're saying this is taken at the largest...
That's right.
This is flat space. I mean, this is flat space physics, right? So he's neglecting expansion, so it's all going to be cut off by the causal horizon. So.
Okay. So if you put that in, you're saying that even if I have a gigantic loop.
Yeah, you can't. It's not until that loop starts interacting with itself that it can actually make gravitational waves. Probably. Yeah.
If you talk about the standard radiation from cosmic string loops, there is some radiation from the super horizon loops, but it's very suppressed compared to when the loop can oscillate, which happens only once it becomes up horizon.
Okay, but you're saying that's no different from some pi mode or something that has a quadrupole?
I don't see it.
No, but that's what you're...
Well, my intuition is just that normally the frequency you get is related to the characteristic scale of the time, and then typically that's set by some fraction of the Hubble scale.
I think it's usually even easier to square... This is actual frequency, it's just the square root of the Hubble scale at the time of production multiplied by the Hubble scale today. That takes care of, so the Hubble scale at that time is comes from the causality part, and the Hubble scale today enters into the problem because of the redshifting. So it's just literally the geometric mean of the Hubble scale today and the Hubble scale at the time of production, if you think there's a causal process.
Which is also translated in this particular case into the fact that Q is bigger than 1, and my specific scale of special importance is sub-horizon. Oh, yeah. It's Q to the 1/4 times the...
Because of the square root, it's probably... It's an order unity factor that.
That's right.
So that's where the geometric mean roughly gives the right result.
It sounds like you're saying causality would tell you it's not possible in general. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think you can apply that to TV scale.
That's not a huge horizon.
Well, but then you're...
Then you have less of an amplitude.
Well, yeah, that's right, exactly. So that's the problem.
Exactly. So then that's the problem.
That's the problem, exactly.
So it's a curve. But you're saying it's a model of dependence no-go theorem.
I think the frequency will always be square root of... this proportional to square root of h in the time of production. That I don't think we can change in any of these causal mechanisms.
Uh-huh.
But that h star, when this is produced, you can... if you don't want inflation with this, you can produce it at whatever h star you want. You can make the frequency small because of that.
I thought the original papers that, like, from Richard and co. that did this showed that you could dial this all the way down to almost down to LIGO, although
only not no, but not consistently with inflationary background.
But then why can't? But you're just assuming that potential is inflation. So why can't you now just
I was just going to address that, but this.
That's what I'm asking. Why can't you just have a Frankenstein potential where I say, I'm just going
to
glue.
I'm trying to answer to that since I arrived.
Inflation potential.
Anyway, Danny's going to answer.
Well, this is helpful to me.
It will be.
No, please.
I think just going. Danny and Talon were discussing exactly this. Right? Can you do this? But even for the simplest cases of monotomy or...
Let's do something like that. Or let's do something linear here, okay? So preliminary estimates of the work in progress we are doing seems that this doesn't solve the problem. Yeah. Okay, the only way we think we could really solve it is that if we make a plateau here and we disconnect the height of this plateau from the curvature of this potential here.
Possible.
That's possible, of course, but what I'm saying is like these kind of scenarios that they open up into linear here, if they do it smoothly enough, then there is still some connection that doesn't allow me to separate these scales. If we do hyperbolic tangent, for instance, that naturally makes this plateau shape here and then power law here, we still suffer the same problem. We really need to make a real disconnection between this part of the potential and the curvature here.
Are you saying a cusp?
No, I'm just saying that the shape of the potential, yeah, the shape of the potential should be disconnected, the form of the minimum here.
That's a parameter, we do think we...
Yes, but it's not identified with the two-thirds model. I think you have additional parameters that you can play with, right?
But I'm asking if that's not enough.
It's not, so if you just use, for example, square root of 1 plus y squared.
But that has a single
scale. That's not enough.
That's not enough, yeah, because it gives this linear at large fields.
Yeah, so, well, I mean, no, phi over m, some m scale, which can be different from Planck.
Okay.
Right. That one parameter, along with the amplitude in front of the potential, those two together does not seem to be enough. Those two parameters don't seem to be enough.
So you don't count those as two.
There's no null growth there,
which prevents that amplitude. Okay.
Absolutely, certainly not from observational point of view, that's for sure, no? So the point is...
Can you just write a toy function that has enough parameters that you have in mind, or you're not sure it ever?
I'm not sure at this point, but I'm pretty sure we can write it down, no doubt, no? Because we just need to disconnect the inflationary properties here from the curvature of the potential there. That's all.
Danny, but this is not what you do with these potentials which have a pole in the kinetic form.
I'm not...
The thing that people call alpha
tractors. The alpha tractors. Could be.
The alpha tractors have only two parameters, so they're not...
The M and lambda.
The star is essentially connected somehow to...
Honestly, this is work in progress for us, but at least from this discussion that was triggered last Friday, we've really understood very well that what is the key points we need. And you definitely need to separate this to make it much smaller than this amplitude. So, for instance, let me address this point and then I finish and then we discuss as much as you guys want. In flat directions, instead of thinking of the inflaton, I think of a flat direction that eventually dominates the universe, or of a moduli field that is initially in a slow roll but then starts oscillating at some point and dominates the energy budget once it's oscillating, say, as matter-like, this is possible because I can choose a very small mass here and a very large amplitude. So in those scenarios, it is possible. The point here which triggered this discussion is that with the standard preheating scenarios that we work out with large field inflationary potentials, even if you do this kind of modifications, unless you really separate this height and properties of the inflationary potential here from the curvature there, it's not possible. It's not possible.
I don't know why the height is in any way relevant. Because you have pi star and omega meet up, which care about the height, so it's not those.
It's more like you want to push omega star to smear it into very small values, basically.
Height is probably not relevant, you are right. Certainly, it's relevant the amplitude of the field, yeah. Which maybe I was naively associating to some height, because as I said, we haven't worked out this in detail. The question is to separate. Let me put it this way.
Yeah,
we need to separate this.
Yeah. From the one that corresponds. So there should be one mass scale that controls the turnover.
The turnover.
And another mass scale at the bottom. But yeah. There are certain potentials even in the string models.
What you're thinking is just the shape of the potential, but suppose you're going to some other field, then it's not necessarily the curvature of the bottom.
This is for the inflatons.
The reason I say that is because this derivation is based on the fact that there was a second coupled field. It's not just one field model, right? Yeah. So it's a coupling also.
Well, this derivation is based on the fact that these guys dominate the energy budget of the universe. Okay, so if I do have, say, some condensate, which could be flat direction or a moduli field that does dominate eventually and then oscillates and produce another quanta of another field coupled to it, all of this applies.
We want to suppress the frequency because we want your phi star to be bigger.
Yeah, as large as possible and the mass scale as small as possible. That's what we want.
Is phi star of the order of the value of the field at the end of inflation always?
So phi star is of the order of?
So what is typical scale?
Well, in these scenarios, so if I do this really single monomial power law thing, this is of the order of Planck mass always.
That's basically fixed, right?
Well, this is the problem in preheating, precisely. That's what I'm saying, that if we literally consider preheating, in order to separate these scales, we need to do a disconnection of the physics here with the curvature of the potential.
And the direction in which you're trying to do that is that you want...
The reason why I want to do that...
The omega over phi small, so right. The 10 to the 10 gets small.
Right.
Is to reduce this 10 to the 10. This is the reason.
Right. So
okay.
So you're looking for a...
These processes of large field... of large field scenarios naturally give rise to very high frequency, which of course is natural because we are producing at sub-horizon but close to the horizon excitations, and at those large energy scales this corresponds to very high frequencies. So essentially we want to decouple this, which amounts to changing the to very small curvature of the potential there, but also decrease the total amount of energy, obviously, because the total amount of energy of the system is proportional to the amplitude of the field square times the frequency square.
Yeah, but you also run into a problem because you want small field inflation at some point. You have low H, so that's a little bit in tension with wanting to make phi large.
Exactly. I think
this is the problem. So this is why, you know, when you are asking me, can I give you a functional form of what is the right potential to do this, you know, we started discussing about this last Friday. We know now where we are heading. We need to work out the forms to see if this is compatible with everything, you know. Yeah, this is a global feature right now. Yeah.
Sorry.
All right.
So it slows down,
so I have two questions. One is, how much of this carries over for tachyonic resonance?
So this is very interesting. Tachyonic preheating can be a very separate case from all of this, because in scenarios like hilltop inflation or hybrid inflation, it is possible to separate completely the energy scale from the constraint from CMB anisotropies, and therefore it's possible to shift by tuning your parameters into very small values into observable frequencies. And this is known. I mean, people worked out this already more than a decade ago, that, for instance, if you think of hybrid preheating, you could produce observable gravitational wave background from tachyonic instability. The problem is that the self-coupling you need for the waterfall field for making it observable at LIGO is of 10 to minus 8 value. For LISA, it's 10 to minus 40. So as long as you are comfortable with that, one can claim there is observable gravitational wave from tachyonic preheating instabilities in this kind of hilltop or hybrid preheating scenarios.
Sorry, which part?
Can I ask another related question? For the case of, so this is all for a case of Asselin, for a case of Q-ball where you have a complex field and that would respond to, for example, a flat direction, and it comes to dominate the matter density later on, so this is a slightly different scenario, of course, than this, but there you have a complex field and these equations, if you set up separately for chi and phi, they will be basically effectively a coupled equation, right?
Yes.
Because the complex field has two components.
Yes.
The couple,
yes.
So.
Yes.
How much of this would carry over?
This is difficult to tell like that on the top of my head, but I know there are papers on preheating from complex fields from, for instance, some of them that come to my mind is from Marco Peloso et al. Already from more than 10 years ago. And essentially, even though you don't have a single field passing through zero, just from the motion of the complex field, you do excite parametrically the preheat fields in a very similar manner. So qualitatively, I would say similar. I wouldn't expect much of a difference. Quantitatively, I don't know the answer. Okay. Yeah. Let me to finish, because I think Mauro probably wants to say something.
I'm sorry. I just have...
Can we put the predictor wires here?
Yes.
Just to show one plot? Yeah.
Suppose there's some dynamics that lowers the frequency by slowing the field on this potential.
So what dynamics doing what on the field, sorry? Because you, well, I don't want to.
Kinetic effects that slow down the field.
Yeah.
Keep it from oscillating as rapidly.
Okay, so some friction that would prevent. Yeah.
I guess that would be bad because it would delay the repeated production of the particle.
Yeah,
on the other hand, it would,
I think this,
on the other hand, it would make the frequency lower.
You might worry you might start inflating again or something.
Maybe.
I think given the parametric dependence of the signals here, which depends on the square root of that ratio, yeah, we would need to slow down a lot the frequency of oscillations to really make it observable, this thing.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I'm afraid of not producing enough stuff due to slowing down things like that.
Okay. I have some thoughts about that, but we should stop.
Just to show you some results numerically, very quickly, how these things really look like. So this is parametrization we obtained from lattice simulations, and at the end of the day, this is for m squared phi squared, assuming this potential would be valid for inflation. And you see the typical frequency we really observe in the lattice is of the order of 10 to 8. Modulated by 2/3, not 1/2, resonance parameter here, normalized to 10 to 4. So you see, it's very difficult to move from this 10 to 8 in these scenarios, because I cannot make this much larger than 10 to 10, otherwise I spoil inflation through relative corrections, and I cannot make it much smaller than this, because otherwise there is no broad resonance. And the typical amplitude is of the order of 10 to minus 11, rather than 10 to minus 7. Okay. And how the actual spectra looks like in the lattice, we do the real-time evolution of the full nonlinear dynamics of the fields, as well as the gravitational wave being sourced by these guys. And it's a single peak always. This is examples of omega gravitational waves versus kappa, the natural momenta. It looks flat to you because I'm changing many orders of magnitude the y-axis, okay? But it's really single peak spectra, what I'm showing you here. And they are typically centered around this famous 1/4 of the resonant parameter I'm choosing. Okay, and if I do the same for lambda phi to the fourth, even if this is even more rolled than m squared phi squared, well, then the frequency is slightly smaller, but still of the order of 10 to 7 hertz. And then the amplitude really changes depending on the resonance parameter, has an oscillatory pattern depending on the resonance parameter, but still it's always between 10 to minus 11 and 10 to minus 12. It's not possible to make it better. The spectra looks like this, single peak, single bump, with some features due to the resonance of the fields. But since we don't have time, I guess we will have to skip those features. But we've parameterized very well in the lattice the position of these features, and the amplitude of the maximum height of the spectrum. And this is what, it's really coming into this into some of these formulas here. And, well, I'm afraid the conclusion is clear. Unless we disconnect completely the inflationary physics from the curvature of the potential at the oscillations after inflation, in a standard preheating scenarios, at least with this coupling I explained, it's not possible to make observable these background gravitational waves. Yeah. And well, I hope that was clear. But if not, I'm happy to continue discussing. Then I guess we leave this for Friday.
So far, if my understanding, there is no self-interaction for your X particle.
There is no self-interaction for the X particle.
So
if there was, I could block parametric resonance,
right,
depending on the strength of the self-coupling, yes.
If I think about there is some self-potential, suppose a self-mice, that will shift your frequency by whatever. We have a two frequency.
Yeah, but if I have self-interactions, I block very easily parametric resonance, because I provide a mass to the field itself, which prevents the violation of adiabaticity to happen.
I think there's still some parameter regime. You don't block that, but you have another intrinsic frequency from the self,
yes,
potential.
And that regime is characterized by very small self-coupling, which doesn't help to make
amplitude high, you're saying. That maybe has a chance to give your frequency.
No, that's what I'm telling you. It doesn't help. So for the regime in which you can allow yet to parametrically resonate without blockage because of the self-interactions, you don't help in the frequency, you know. In order to help, I would need to make to shift the frequency, as you are saying. But to do that, this is the cases where the self-interacting mass of the self-interacting preheat field blocks the parametric resonance. So it's difficult interplay to play. Yes. Sorry.
The spectrum where you neutral the omega currents. Yes. It seems it's like the first one is pretty flat at a lower frequency. How low does it go?
Well, the thing is, really, you know, our lattice simulations are very limited in volume, of course, because it's very difficult to do very large lattice simulations. So I think these were 256, and depending on the resonance parameter, in particular for the very small ones, we cannot capture so well the k to the 3 tail that is expected due to causality. So eventually, any of these backgrounds should fall as k to the 3. Okay, because this corresponds to the super horizon modes, and there cannot be particular excitation there. Sometimes it's not possible to capture it well, you know. So I cannot tell you how that will scale, when it will turn k to the 3, because I will need bigger, you know, I have a natural infrared cutoff here, which is given by the volume of my lattice simulations. So I will need bigger volume simulations in order to probe more infrared.
Not quite like a peak around a certain frequency.
Kind of pretty. It looks kind of flattened, but you know, this is roughly one decade, so you should expect at some point it goes down. You know, it's very difficult to capture it. It has to go down because there is no physics there, you know. But it's difficult to capture it. However, to trust the lattice simulation, what we need is that there are some intermediate scale that dominates, you know. So then, in principle, it's fine. We just don't have enough infrared resolution to capture that tail.
Is there any good analytical estimation that sort of can fit your numerical result, or you really have to do the simulation?
Is there analytical? There is analytical parametrization of this amplitude. This is what I was just given by these formulas. Sorry. Okay. This is the analytical parametrization of the amplitude.
For the spectral shape,
I can only tell you, this captures the peak, then I can tell you on the very infrared you die as k to the 3, and on the very UV above the cutoff scale of excitation you die exponentially. Okay. That's generic feature. But the actual shape depends on the case, and hence of the very complicated nonlinear dynamics of each case. You know, so for instance here, look, there are all these features. Which, you know, when I tell you an amplitude of a peak, I'm just telling you the rough amplitude of this. But in reality, there are substructure of peaks due to the actual structure of the resonance of the preheat field that develops peaks in this scenario. And gravitational wave background spectrum inherits these peaks, you see. But parametrization of the global shape is too difficult. Parametrization of the global amplitude is what it really matters in order to discuss observability. This is what we provided in this paper.
I think it's usually it's really a peak because only a few decades at most in K. Right? So it's really a peak. It doesn't extend much because of the K.
In the moment this goes down as K to the 3, if you put this in a global, let's say, omega gravitational waves versus frequency plot, it will be really a bump. Okay, with exponential tail on the UV, k to the 3 in the infrared, and then the funny shape in the top of the peak, you know, in the center of the peak.
Yeah. But is there an easy way to understand those random bumps that appear? Because you saw some of them at low Q, then they disappeared at intermediate, then reappeared at high.
It's
completely random.
No, it's not random. It's not random at all. This has to do with the structure of lambda phi to the fourth, but this happens in any phi to the n guy who has self-resonances, which actually are all of them except phi to the 2, that has no self-resonances because it's linear physics. So essentially, for example, lambda phi to the 4th, it's a totally conformal theory that allows me to remove expansion of the universe, and you can do it conformally equivalent in Minkowski. So what Kaloyan was explaining the other day applies directly, these resonant bands. So essentially, those peaks.
So those are literally just like the Fourier bands from the previous one of the self interaction.
So those are secondary peaks which come from rescattering of particles from the first primary peak and the condensate.
So they're not the
These ones have the origin in the floquet, the higher peaks.
Yeah. But yeah, that was discovered in 1997 by, you know, Plevnikov and Tkachev.
Yeah, but that's what they say. But I always thought, or because also if you look at the paper of Greene, Kaufman, Linder, Starobinsky, the one on lambda phi to the fourth, I thought they were predicting the presence of these peaks based on the resonances of higher modes.
I think it's the first mode you get, and then it's just
and then we're scattering out of the first.
You get multiples of that.
Yeah, this could be. This could be. Sorry, guys.
It's not multiple Floquet exponents.
No, no, okay.
The first one predicts the first peak, and then rescattering.
Because what happens because it's exponential growth. The one that's most important grows and then rescatters. You don't have a chance to grow. In this case.
No.
So those other resonances at higher peaks are completely relevant
in this case. Yeah.
Is there an easy way to estimate their like k values and things like that?
Yeah, it's just small.
They just like integer multiples.
There's also like I don't know if Galen said this already, but it's if you change the power from phi to the fourth to phi to the other end.
Mm-hmm.
There are peak structure, but it's sort of there's a different structure to it. The phi to the four is the only one that where you have this rescattering peaks in a very special way. Otherwise, there's a slightly different peak structure that you produce.
Actually, it's very beautifully the lambda phi to the fourth, how the self-resonance that give rise to these rescattered peaks, those peaks really survive in the gravitational wave background. Whereas here I have a couple of them in the lambda phi to the fourth self-resonance. The gravitational wave background from that self-resonance really inherits the whole structure of harmonic peaks.
And what are the widths of these peaks from? Is there that an easy way? Is like, in the sense that it seems like this peak, these peaks might be an interesting way to differentiate, for example, phase transitions versus preheating, because I don't think phase transitions have this effect because there's nothing similar.
That's right.
And so if.
Yeah.
Because it looks like LIGO might actually, or sorry, LISO might actually would have the resolution if
well,
you put everything to
the problem here would be that they are not in the frequency band to be observed, which is
the discussion today. But,
yes, this would be.
What you said to generate the.
But I for CISO, instance.
I would say is actually very generic for low scale inflation models.
Yeah,
example,
but.
Hybrid, right?
The
whole
M-square,
point of hybrid was the cancel.
M squared phi squared models, I have single peak, you see. So I don't know to what extent, you know, you would need to do a study one to one case to see this structure of peaks. I suspect, you know, these peaks are the result of having this self resonance, okay? But if you have preheat field, typically this is stronger than self-resonance if you choose sufficiently strong coupling.
Mm-hmm.
In that case, with sufficiently broad resonance to the preheat field, you would have single broad single bump. Like
okay, so this is phi squared.
This is phi squared.
Okay, with no self-resonance, and so there are no peaks.
Yeah, exactly. But also in I think lambda phi to the fourth. Okay, here they are not particularly large resonant parameters, but if I show you particularly large, then I think we'll be dominated by a single peak, slightly towards the right. Yeah.
Okay.
But Rafael, probably we should stop or change
well,
the
I
name
think
Mauro.
At this point, there's not so much point in stopping anymore.
Okay, so we continue discussing.
So we could keep discussing, and then Mauro on Friday.
Sorry, Mauro.
It does turn out to be correct that covering preheating cosmic strings and the sun does not fit in.
So we confirm right there. So, well, we can continue discussing if you guys want.
Answer the other thing, sorry. In terms of features, even when you produce sort of non-topological structures like q-balls and also on itself, there also you see structure. You see one harmonic and the second harmonic and so on from their formation as well.
So, okay, so I guess you're talking about the case we discussed before where
yes.
There's no preheat field, it's just
yes.
All self.
All self. So, there again, you see a structure.
And it's also from scattering again there?
Yeah, so first collapse, you know the main mode that goes nonlinear first, that produces the first peak.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes up first, and then you see some harmonics of that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, in this case of collapse objects, it's not completely that, because what also happens is some scales become spherical, so those kind of don't produce any gravitational waves.
Yeah.
So that also produces dips then, right? So those scales are not really there, to produce gravitational waves at that scale. So that also plays a role in terms of what would give you some shape.
Yeah, but I guess, is it fair to say then, you just in general, peaks like this, if you'd say this is one of the interesting phenomenological features of it, always come from self-interactions of whatever the reheat field.
So far, I would expect that, because if you have preheat field with Brough resonance, I think it's really overtaking those peak structure by the growth of this infrared single band of your preheat field. At least in the typical scenarios I've explored, this really happens.
Okay, so you say this is a narrow resonance type effect?
It's narrow in the sense that you are probing only the narrow tip of the resonant band, because this is what happens in the self-resonances.
I mean, roughly, even a self-resonance case, you can have broad resonance. It's just, for example, a potential that opens up away from the minimum has quite a broad range of k's.
But I wouldn't call that broad resonance, because it comes through rescattering, probably the opening up of your spectrum there.
Broad range.
Because of the non-linearity, you know, not because of resonant effect. So here, this is called broad resonance because the whole infrared band is resonating.
So when the potential opens up, right, the first band is not narrow. It's actually
It's
all broad band.
Is that a tachyonic effect?
It's kind of
it's a tachyonic resonance. That's why.
So it's still broad in that sense.
Well, the answer is at the end, any detail depends on the potential you take. You know.
So if I take a Fourier transform of this, do I get a feature in some two-point correlation function? Right. So I have perfect angular gravitational wave detector, and it would just be some.
This reminds me something which I'm not sure it's really what you are asking. So this is spectral features in the spectrum, these peaks, but I would expect them the same at every direction in a sky, okay? But if because I would expect the same phenomena coming from any place.
Sure, so C and B, if I Fourier transform it, I get the error, right?
Well, it's not if you just Fourier transform, you have to stack on the hot peaks.
Yeah,
I guess you can do similar exercises where you can just...
Yeah. But here there is another exercise, which is if you preheat into a field that already sustains some super horizon amplitude. So imagine I tune the coupling in such a way that this field is heavy during inflation, except towards the last epochs. Then it picks up some superhorizon fluctuations, and then you preheat on top of that initial condition. This is like modulated preheating stuff. Well, that gives rise to an angular modulation in the sky of this signal. And this we have computed in detail with Artur Rajanti. But this is not related to these spectral features.
But it'd just be on really tiny scales.
Yeah, right.
More than
you want to resolve that, that's around. It's smaller than Hubble scale in that moment, so it's absolutely tiny angular resolution today. That's right. If that's what you meant, But there is, since you are asking about this anisotropy, let's say in real space, the way to do this would be by this modulated preheating stuff, which means that you preheat into fields that are already modulated. Then the nonlinear dynamics are really sensitive to the initial condition of your preheat field, and this gives rise to a very large pattern of anisotropies. Actually, it's a angular scale invariant anisotropies pattern in CLs, so L squared times CL equal constant, of the order of 1% for at least the best case we could work out. So it's different from what you are asking, but it's related in the physical effect you wanted.
Maybe since we're discussing it would be, I know people here have worked on this, so one of the things that all of these backgrounds that we produce, right, at least in the models that were written down today, typically, unless there's something special, where you're moving the mass from the bottom, become matter-dominated after production. As you produce this, and then you have a matter-dominated phase, which means as you've written there, right, the amplitude of the gravitational waves drops quite a bit.
So what case are you thinking that is matter-domination, sir?
I think, for example, if you had lambda phi to the fourth, or lambda phi n squared phi squared with this case, you know that you will end up with a matter-dominated equation, a very broad resonance.
That's right.
Because eventually the m squared phi squared.
That's right. Yeah. But I would say only for that case, right? Precisely because you have that very large mass.
Even if it's a small mass, right? If you don't have anything else,
you have a small mass of the preheat field.
Small mass of the inflaton field. Mm-hmm. Eventually, even if you 0.001% of it is left over, it very quickly will come to dominate.
If it has a mass, yes, yeah, yeah.
It will come to dominate. Right. So you will end up with a mass.
Yeah, which will give you some dilution of these signals. Yes.
Classical physics.
So I think. So you should maybe say it because I know you.
Then reheating is enhanced by both effects. I mean, then you have to do the actual kinetic thermal fail period.
To actually get rid of the mass. I'm saying that just by doing the classical simulations, you miss that part of how you are going to get radiation out, because these things don't go to radiation out much easily.
Well, yeah, certainly. I mean, this is based on those ingredients. I mean, this type of analysis, if there is a mass there, a mass that is not induced through that interaction, but a bare mass parameter, I agree, this will be a new parameter that will change the scaling of the evolution of the universe. You need to get rid of it. You could think of perturbative decays of the inflaton to prevent that, but again, you need to introduce new element. I mean, this discussion is based on this. In the moment we change this picture,
But this picture has to change, right? Yeah. Because we don't live in a universe with those fields.
Yeah, this picture has to
change. You've got a couple that...
I give you an example. For instance, in Higgs inflation, the inflaton is the Higgs of the standard model, and you reheat producing all the standard model species, and actually the dominant channel is parametric resonance in the gauge fields, precisely because the Higgs is oscillating. And then you would have this kind of phenomena, you see? And then you reheat into the standard model, which become radiation degrees of freedom. I switch into radiation-dominated universe, and I have produced all these phenomena. So this depends on the model, honestly. And of course, these are toy models. If we want to explain the reheating of the universe, I think we need to understand where the full degrees of freedom into which we are reheating to comes from. We certainly are not put here, no?
I think the one thing that sometimes that worries me, right, that if you just take preheating and then you ask, okay, what is needed? Suppose preheating happens, but then you have so much freedom in terms of what the decay rate could be.
Yeah.
You get to radiation.
Yeah.
You have to BBN, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you have a very long time scale. And so unless there is guidance from theory that says that you do actually go to radiation domination quickly, there will be this big uncertainty. Because naively there will be mass terms, and unless you can show that it decays away quick, things decays away quickly, there is a huge uncertainty.
Yes.
So there will be need for some guidance to show that okay, this actually does happen quickly.
I completely agree with that. There's huge uncertainty in what is the expansion history until we get into radiation domination, because we don't know how we get there in reality. No. Absolutely.
How would you make it decay quickly, but still not have large self-interactions that prevent all this?
Into fermions. The Yukawa coupling of the inflaton into some fermions.
Yeah, but then why wouldn't that cause large self-interactions? Because if you want it to decay quickly, those Yukawas have to be order one.
I just make it quickly enough after all these things happen. You know, this thing happened immediately after the end of inflation. Mm-hmm. And the coupling of the Yukawa interaction is small enough that it takes slightly longer than this to happen, you know?
Usually like self-interactions have to be like 10 to the minus 20 or type numbers.
So
that seems like it's sort of
So what self-interaction, I mean...
In the sense that like if it can decay into two fermions, then you can draw a loop that shows three interactions, four-point interactions and everything.
Yeah.
And so I was wondering how much at odds those are actually with each other, because you need a four-point interaction, let's say, to be really, really small, but then you need it to reheat fast enough so that the matter, what's left in the inflaton,
decays
fast. And so I was just wondering what's...
I'm not sure anybody has worked out those details, taking into account so many ingredients at the same time, you know?
But again, this is limited for thinking about the inflaton, right? So for many years, people have considered the case, for example, of cuballs that later on decay from the high-order baryon number violating operators and so on. So this has been already considered in such scenarios for like 30 years or so. So this is Well, this discussion is for particular for case of the infinite.
Yeah, yeah. The discussion here is that
spectator of flat direction.
It's a different story. It's a different story. Yeah. It's a different story. Well, but it's still interesting enough this discussion, no? Because it's like imagine we develop eventually a detector at high frequencies, and we could try to probe these interactions, you know. As you see, everything I'm writing here depends on the interaction strength, no? Because it depends on this Q parameter. So you could literally try to look for the interactions in the features of the spectrum, the location of the peak, the shape, the height, etc. And the point is, the final amplitude is going to be very determined by what is this history that we don't know, which requires extra ingredients. So, yeah, I think it's a generic problem of preheating scenarios to know how to connect with the
real. No, I'm just saying this is a relatively specific set of scenarios. That's it. That was just
no, but even if you have spectator fields, you still need to specify the couplings. You don't know.
Sure. But for example, I mean, there are generic models that you consider, like MSSample or something.
But how generic do you buy that?
Well, I mean, couplings? I mean, that is another question. So
that's the main thing that you don't know.
Well, sure. I'm just saying that there are some models that, in some theorists' minds, it's a generic, and this is one set of scenarios. No, sure, but this has been an ongoing question for the whole discussion, right? So,
So what's a detector? You mentioned to detect 10 to 11 hertz.
So, well,
I
definitely don't have a detector measuring at that frequency right now. But
have you heard? Yeah, because have you heard anybody?
Yeah, yeah. There are. I was going to tell you.
Microwave cavities.
There are a couple of groups working actually with micro cavities, for instance, technology, which they are making proposals to detect at gigahertz, 10 to 9 hertz. The problem is the sensitivity they have arrived to is completely, it's bad for this, obviously. No. So there is no. If you want. I joined a workshop on high-frequency gravitational wave detectors that was celebrated at ICTP a few months ago, and they put for the first time together, I think, a bunch of theorists and experimentalists, and it was very depressing to realize that the experimental perspective looks very bad in the direction of high-frequency detectors.
The problems at high frequencies, the strains are so low, and so typically we write omega GW, but they care about H itself.
Exactly.
And there's a factor of K.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very difficult problem at those frequencies to have a sufficient good detection of the strain of the gravitational wave. This is true. Yeah. So somebody should come with a good idea. Because there is definitely very rich physics, you know, if we could prove. I think one message to take home is precisely. You know, this is pretty the opposite message of instead of trying to make it observable, you know, this is the natural outcome,
right.
You know, from high energy scale inflation, high frequency gravitational wave backgrounds. So it would be very nice if eventually we could measure something in these high frequencies. But yeah, it looks bad, the case right now.
There's, of course, a nice thing also that there are no astrophysical things there.
Well, it's a bad thing because you can't convince anybody to build anything there. But
no, you know what? If there was the technology and we had a clear prediction, the problem is all our predictions depend on all our assumptions. You know, on the scenarios. I don't mean on the assumptions on the technique to compute them. I mean on the assumptions of the actual ingredients for the physics. So this is the problem. We cannot make just one prediction. However, we can say generically that from high energy scale inflationary models, if there is preheating with this non-perturbative type of effects, natural outcome is high frequency background gravitational waves. Yeah.
All right.
This was a discussion. Okay, so we leave it here.